and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. Good afternoon and welcome to Dialect Radio for the week beginning Sunday, the 1st of August. I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Michaela Dennis.
Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM. That's 103.2 FM up there in Preston. Hello to people in Birmingham also, Unity FM on 93.5 in the Midlands. Our guest this week is Guthrie Kennard, all the way from Fort Worth in Texas. He's on his yearly visit to Bristol and has been playing at music venues around the city. Charles Thompson, our veteran sports reporter, gives a post-mortem on the outcome of the World Cup final. And also, this week, we welcome Julian Parry, the former surveyor of Bristol University, is here to tell us about council waste contracts. Yeah, I'd think that didn't sound very interesting, but he tells us how the system is designed to keep local companies out and massive multinationals in, and how council employees can collude in the process. And was the mystery of Jack the Ripper tied up with Freemasonry?
Our features this week are by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. Malcolm Grease reads a chapter from Secrets and Lies by David Southwell, and Tim Burrows reads us one of his poems. Jeff Sparks is also back in the studio with his What Song Guide and Song of the Week.
Well, I'd like to introduce to the studio Guthrie Kennard. Without further ado, you're going to play us a song about where you're from, which is Texas.
Yeah, John, how are you doing? You doing all right?
I'm doing all right. I'm liking the look, the hat, the clothes. It's excellent.
Thank you. I've just made about 5 pounds out on the street, so you just came up and gave me money. Alex is laughing. Well, thank you, though. It's what'd you ask me now? I'm sorry, I don't even get high. So
how long have you been in the UK?
Oh, for about 3 weeks.
Okay. So what are you doing in the UK?
I just haven't come to see my friends. You know, I went over to Sweden for a benefit over there a couple of weeks ago, and out of the deal, I wanted to, you know, come and spend some time with my friends I hadn't seen for a while and just have a good time and beat the Texas heat.
Okay.
Because next week it's back into the inferno.
And would you like to...
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
What's your first song called?
This song's called Country Town. This is about East Texas. This is about a bunch of old blues cats, and there's a highway running down through East Texas and through Gilmer, Texas, which is home of Freddie King and stuff. Barking, bullfrogs croaking, the hogs in the porcupine. Six string shooting, barefoot shoeing on the outskirts of town. A blind lemon moaning by the yellow rose down by the Cater track. Once upon a time, the sun couldn't set on a blues man's back. Preacher man preaching, thumping the word early Sunday morning in church. A congregation, holy roller, save a sinner's in the name of the ghost. There gotta be something in the natural down here, whiskey, wine, or gin. Big mama shaking everything she's got, ain't no man has ever slain. Down in a country town. Down in a country town. Back in the pines off Highway 80, half a mile down the old mill road. Sure to be holding four of a kind with a go-to sparkle of a smile. Down in dirty Miss Lucibel, flirting with a dollar in her eye. Lulu Mo says she's the daughter of the devil, a voodoo child in the skies. From the midnight hour to the rooster crow, clothespins out on line. Scarecrow working wood stove, burning and the eagle, it does fly. Down by the river with the mason jar, where the old test of gasoline. May I be fishing in the back alley kitchen, neck bone, taters and greens. Down in a country town. Down in a country town.
Well, if that don't put you in the mood for Texas, I don't know what will. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you, John.
What, how many times have you been to the UK before then? Are you a common visitor to our shores?
Oh, gosh, probably. How long, Nikki? 15 years I came over. Eddie Martin, I don't know. Eddie is a great blues guitarist out of Bristol here, and he was over in Texas. And I play bass as well. And so when Eddie came over, we ended up, my brother and I backed him up, and he said, would you like to come over to England? And we said, sure, you know, we were trying to get over here since like 65, since the Beatles, so finally we got over here, you know, and ever since I've been coming over here about once a year. And then there's another guy that I played with. He's from Texas, but he's a blues player, Eugene Hideaway Bridges. So we did two, did an album with him over here, did one in the United States with him, and we played I played a couple of gigs with Eugene, and then did another album with a cat out of Texas called Rocky Athus. He's playing with John Mayall now.
Yeah.
So I did two records with him playing bass, and I toured over here with Rocky Athus group. So
tell me a little bit about how long you've been playing the guitar then.
Well,
a long time, I assume.
I'm really a bass player, you know. I've been playing bass more longer than I've been playing guitar, and but I've been writing all my life, you know, and so I decided about, I mean, I was talking to Rebecca earlier today. It's just, you know, I was in London about 7 years ago, and I went to Virgin Records down there, and I looked at all these blues records I'm playing on. I said, you know, I'm just kind of tired of playing for everybody else, you know, and not that I don't love playing with them or anything, but I think I can, you know, I'm just ready for myself, you know, to put out a record and start writing and, you know, put it out on CDs and stuff.
How long has it taken you to sort of put the material together? Have you been collecting a lot of material that you've written whilst you've been playing for other people?
I have. You know, I've played with a lot of great people. I've always prided myself on playing with people that have their own identity and as well as being their own artist.
Who are some of your favorites that you've played with?
Well, as far as the blues is concerned, Smokin' Joe Kubek is a, you know, well-known Texas blues player, Benoist King. Rocky Hill, he's Dusty Hill's older brother. He had passed away, I think, last year. Great, great guy. Mark Benno, who played with Leon Russell and the Solemn Choir. And then he became just his own artist as well. I mean, people from, he was on a long time ago on AM Records. You know, people, Eric Clapton, on and on, Rita Coolidge. He's a songwriter as well. And he won a Grammy for one of the songs he had written for Beverly Hills Cop with Eddie Murphy. Is that right? Maybe. And Mark's just a great writer. Buddy Miles from Jimi Hendrix Experience.
Yeah.
You know, I love Buddy. He was great. Just so many great, you know, Texas players. I was very fortunate to, you know.
And what would you like to play for us?
Well, I'm going to do this for Rebecca. She, I just wrote this song for a couple of friends of mine who got married. It's a real short song. I didn't want to spend a lot of time on writing a song that, you know, if the marriage wasn't going to work.
You got to be optimistic when you go to a wedding, surely.
Well, I was writing for the preacher, get me a little closer into heaven. This goes out to my good friends, Steve and Nikki. And this is called Forever Yours. From the heart of my soul, I'll serve you well. Heaven sent me my angel on the wings of a white dove. as long as the sun rises over this earth, I'll protect you for better or worse. I'm forever yours. I'm forever yours. In my darkest hour, in my prayers and dreams, I've waited so long to believe in love again. You make me feel like a newborn child. Fate is not our past, it's the love we found. I'm forever yours. I'm forever yours. From the heart of my soul, I'll serve you well. Heaven sent me my angel on the wings of a white dove. As long as the sun rises over this earth, I'll protect you for better or worse. I'm forever yours. I'm forever yours. I'm forever yours. I'm forever yours.
Thank you very much to Guthrie Kennard there. And let's hope he comes back in the next few years. That'd be brilliant. We'll see him again.
BCFM 93.2 FM. Your choice, your voice.
Well, over to our first feature now by Tony Gosling. Would you feel cheated if you were spending time and effort sorting out your waste glass in the belief it was being recycled, only to learn that in fact it was just going straight to landfill sites along with all your other waste? This week we welcome back Julian Parry, the former surveyor of Bristol University, to tell us about glass recycling, but also how the system of council waste contracts is designed to keep local companies out and giant foreign multinationals in. That means the proceeds go straight out of Bristol and straight out of the country. Julian also tells us about how council employees can collude in the process. Dialect's Tony Gosling asked him, who is allowed to apply for waste contracts?
Under the law, anybody can be a waste contractor. Anybody can have a waste management licence, and everybody just has to apply and pay the huge fees that are involved. But of course, it's a lot more complicated than that. And here we get into the question of qualification. You can have somebody say, I'm going to be a waste contractor. You try and qualify. You try and go through a hugely tortuous system of you've got to have this, you've got to have that. Oh, you're a compost man, are you? You've got to comply with PAS 100, which itself is highly questionable. And there are all sorts of... I know of one contractor who's a very good contractor, actually independent, got a whole big place, 66 acres, very, very experienced at what he does, couldn't qualify because PAS 100 hadn't quite come through. There are all sorts of little nuances to this, which mean that at the end of the day, many may apply, few are chosen, and it's usually one of the good old few who gets the job.
Now, the thing is that these restrictions are there for a reason, aren't they? It's to make sure that, that if someone is getting a waste contract, that they really are up to the job.
There's truth in that, and we do need to have people who are up to the job. But, of course, you've got to remember that whether or not they're up to the job is a matter of qualification in that they have to have certificates of technical competence. And if they haven't got certificates of technical competence, what are known as whammy tab certificates, then they're not allowed to operate at all. So to say that they have to have those qualifications, and then you need this, and you need that, and you need this coverage, which hasn't quite come through, so you're out on this one, and then you get all sorts of other little things, you know, how is your pension fund arrangements, and are they adequate, and you start to realise that actually you're not talking about making sure people are adequate to the job and qualified. What they're making sure is that the tripwires are there so that only the big boys can play.
Over the last 20 years, much of what statutory duty local authorities have has been privatised and contracted out. If you could change just one or two things about the way local authority contracts of all sorts are awarded, what would you do?
Well, the first thing I think is you've got to look at the people who are awarding those contracts, particularly the senior officers of any council, because they're very difficult to get rid of. In fact, they're almost impossible to get rid of. There is no mechanism for getting rid of them. Oh, you can talk about going to the Standards Board for England. No, you can't. It's just been abolished.
But surely elected members, the councillors, they can get rid of a council officer if they want to without too much trouble.
Theory is one thing, practice is another. There is a real problem that, because a lot of the councillors themselves are questionable. Now, I was at one point criticised very heavily by the police for putting out a report that said 80% of councillors, in my opinion, did not have the intellectual wherewithal to perform the functions of the office to which they'd been elected. I had a very senior police officer ring me up and said, Julian, we really cannot have you going around the place saying 80% of them are inadequate. He said, that is a gross underestimate.
About your waste management system, one of the things I like about it is the idea you just throw everything in and we use modern technology to sort out all the different types of waste. Now, first of all, do you know anything about what's going on with glass waste and bottle waste? Because I'm constantly hearing rumours that this is just simply being sorted out by ordinary families, children, etc., and then just going into landfill.
Well, yes, it is, because there's only a certain amount of cullet that you can put into new glass mixes. And there is a need for research there to see how we can reuse more and more and more. One of the ideas that I've heard of is using it in road surfacing so that you make the road glitter. Obviously, it's not sharp, so it cuts your tyres. But there are all sorts of things that could be done, but there's a huge amount more research needs doing. Now, in the JTP system, a lot of the glass ends up in the furnace. Now, glass, as you probably know, melts at 593 degrees centigrade. There's more than enough temperature in the furnaces to melt what glass gets in there. And of course, that just runs out to the bottom because the new burning system runs on an ash bed with air nozzled in at various angles. But the glass would run out at the bottom as a melt. And I am sure that it can be taken and used elsewhere.
Have you any idea what proportion of the glass we put into bottle banks actually just ends up in the landfill?
No, because that sort of information, you will understand that the companies concerned would guard it very jealously. And whilst they might tell you, they might have to kill you afterwards.
What about your own system? It's not being taken up with much interest in North Somerset or here in Bristol. Are there other local authorities that are interested?
Well, abroad, we are involved in Eastern Europe. We have agents there working in the Balkans, in Greece. We have people in Israel, Egypt, Jordan. We are about to appoint people in Australia. We have people in China, and we've had interest coming back from Shanghai and from Dojiang Province and Hong Kong. We are about to appoint an agent in Taiwan. We also have interest in Angola, where 200,000 houses are being built and people are using the system for servicing the new townships. We have interest coming in from Peru, and we are interested in getting the thing into Brazil. So we have suddenly blossomed, as it were, partly because we've realized that there's just no point fighting against the establishment in this country if they decide that they want to do something, such as burn all the waste or collect it separately so they can make it look as if they're being very environmental, then really and truthfully, there isn't much you're going to do about it. Hopefully, governments across the rest of the world are far more sensible. Although I will say, and I must say this, from what I've seen of the coalition government that has just come in, particularly announcement from Eric Pickles MP, I have every hope that there will be a change of mind and that there will be a completely new approach to these things.
Thank you to Julian Parry there, former surveyor of Bristol University, who we heard from a few weeks ago about his JT Protocol Waste System. That's the JTP system to you and I. Julian mentioned that, and that means that our waste can be collected all in the same bag and can be sorted out back at the waste plant, which means less work for you. And thank you to Dialect's very own Tony Gosling.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Or go onto our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Our next feature by Anthea Page was recorded during her recent trip to Bulgaria and Romania. It's in two parts, and it's about the communist era in Sofia, the capital of Bulgaria, as told by Luca.
My name is Luca.
And can you tell us about the communist years in Sofia?
Communist years in Sofia, they cannot be separated from the communist years in the whole of the country.
Were you born in Sofia?
I was born in Sofia.
And you were a doctor?
No, I wasn't a doctor, but I studied. I didn't get a diploma.
Was that due to any particular reason?
When you say no, when they try to send you to a brigade in to pick up crops or to dig ditches or something, you may find yourself finally without a diploma, no matter how years you have studied. And
so it was totally corrupt then, when the Russians were in power?
It's not the Russians that came to power here, but their Bulgarian supporters.
Oh, I see. They supported the communist regimes.
Yes. That's why they survived for a period of nearly 50 years. They supported the Soviet Union and the communist regime.
What effect did that have on many people in Sofia? The professional people?
What do you mean?
You know, like the professional people, the people with proper professions. How did communism affect them? Did they punish professional people?
They punished them, and they punished the Bulgarian intelligentsia when they came to power in 1944. So many people were killed, teachers, people from different fields of walks of life, so to say. Warriors were killed, thousands of people were killed when they came to power in 1944. Preachers as well.
The religious.
The religious people were killed as well.
So when you say killed, were they taken to prison and shot?
They were taken from their families, they were tortured, most of them, they were taken to the local militia stations, then they suddenly disappeared from there, and there were some camps organized for people who didn't want to support the communist regime. These concentration camps survived till maybe 1960, 1961, 1962.
So did you know anyone who disappeared?
Yes. On my family side, some people disappeared. On my neighbor's side, some people disappeared.
And then they were never seen again?
They were never seen again. Yeah. This fact had been known, but as the communists were partners and they were part of the coalition that fought the Nazi Germany, the Western governments didn't care much about what they did in our countries here when they came to power, because the Western countries, democracies, were supported by the communists and by the Soviet Union in their war against Nazi Germany. So thousands of innocent people were killed here and nobody moved a finger.
Do you think people feel a bit of resentment then about the West not helping?
Some people, definitely, yeah. But there is a difference. The problem is not that the West didn't help directly. The problem is that they economically, somehow or other, supported the communist regimes, no matter that they knew exactly the Western countries knew that. They ignored it, and because of their economical and financial interests, they were partners with the communist regimes.
Was this Khrushchev?
No, Khrushchev was in Soviet Union, and in Bulgaria we had a Bulgarian prime minister who was at the same time the first party secretary, so to say, the first secretary of the Bulgarian Communist Party. In fact, was our prime minister, and he was in power since 1956 to 1989.
What was his name?
Todor Živković.
So he approved of all this that was going on?
He and his comrades definitely were the people to be blamed for what was happening in Bulgaria through all those years. In fact, Živković's regime survived because he was saying and supporting everything, saying yes and supporting everything that was ordered from the Soviet Union and their Communist Party.
Do you think many countries were frightened of the Soviet Union?
Countries were frightened. It was normal for the countries to be frightened by the Soviet Union because the only field they were good in was to produce nuclear weapons. So, you know, this devil's alternative. You've got a writer, Frederick Forsyth, once he wrote about it. We either should feed them with grain or they should set us on fire and set the whole world on fire. So,
do you think people were frightened by what had happened in the Ukraine?
Most Bulgarians didn't know the real situation in the Soviet Union, and they had an idealistic image of the communist system. Most of the average people, the common Bulgarian people, in 1944, in the 50s, they didn't have an exact idea what the real face of the Soviet communist system is. So they knew nothing about this cannibalism and starvation in Ukraine or in Russia. They didn't know the millions of people the Stalin's regime killed and put into the concentration camps. But we had concentration camps here in Bulgaria too.
Whereabouts were the concentration camps then?
Spread throughout the country. Every other dam or every artificial lake or ditch or heavy concrete work was performed by people who opposed the regime and by people who wanted to get rid of the communist regime. And they were put into these concentration camps, they were killed there, they were tortured there. This fact became known when the democratic forces, so to say, came to power in 1989.
That was Luca talking about the communist era in Sofia. Next week you can hear part two of how his family suffered under the communist regime in Bulgaria.
Well, from one real horror in the 20th century to one in the 9th or 10th century and Victorian England, Jack the Ripper. Back in the 19th century, as I'm sure you'll know, London it was the scene, and Jack the Ripper killings shocked the nation. Over 130 years later, the mystery is slowly unrolling as former Freemasons explain connections between these seemingly senseless killings and Freemasonry. Bill Schnoblin used to be a Freemason himself, and in a recent talk he examined the connections between the Jack the Ripper murders and the secret Masonic rituals which he was privy to before he learnt the craft and became a Christian.
These are examples of how Masons can cause a miscarriage of justice. But here is probably the most celebrated example of this in the history of the West. Jack the Ripper, a Freemason? The answer to that question is yes, one way or another. Let me explain. For those of you that may not know, Jack the Ripper is probably the Western world's first known serial killer. He murdered 8 prostitutes in Whitechapel district of London in the year 1888, and he had the whole city of London terrified. This was Victorian England, mind you, and nothing like this had ever happened in the history of England that anybody knew of. And here's what happened. They mounted a huge investigation. The man in charge of the investigation was Police Commissioner Warren, who was a Freemason. At that time, the Prime Minister of England, as is often the case, was a Freemason. The heir presumptive to the throne of England, the Duke of Clarence, was also a Mason. And the physician to the royal court at the time, Dr. Gull, was a Freemason. Now, here's what actually happened. The 8 women who were killed, if you study this, and I happen to have been, before I even became a Mason, I was kind of a Jack the Ripper buff. I'd read several of the books about him and kind of studied up. And when I became a Mason, I realized that the horrible way, these unfortunate women were murdered was in accord with Masonic ritual gestures. One of them had her throat cut from ear to ear. Another one had her bowels ripped out of her body and thrown over her left shoulder, and so on and so on. These were Masonic ritual murders. But why? Well, here's what happened. Believe it or not, the Duke of Clarence, who was second in line to the throne of England, had fallen in love with a prostitute named Annie Crooks. And he married this woman. Now that was bad enough, but he had a child by her, a little girl. And this woman, horror of horrors, was a Roman Catholic. Now if you understand the way the Parliament and the monarchy work in England, there is a law that no member of the royal family can ever marry a Roman Catholic because of the adversarial relationship that existed for centuries between the Church of Rome and the Church of England. And so this would have shaken the very foundations of the throne of England. So Dr. Gull, who was a physician and surgeon, had Annie Crooks committed to a mental institution where she died by suicide several months later, because of course in those days mental hospitals were not really Club Med, not that they are today either. The little girl, who was 2 or 3 at most, was placed in a Catholic orphanage. But every woman in Whitechapel, from Catherine Beddoes to Mary Jane Kelly, that knew of the wedding and knew Annie Crooks, were horribly murdered to conceal the secrets of a brother master Mason. Now, you'll notice the thing up there on the board says the Jewess will not be blamed for nothing. Now, you might wonder, what the heck does that mean? Well, this phrase was scrawled on an alley in Whitechapel during the height of the hysteria. What does that phrase mean? Well, believe it or not, Police Commissioner Warren ordered it immediately struck from the alley. It was taken off the alley, erased. He claimed it was because he did not want to have anti-Semitic riots, because he was afraid people would believe the Jews were out there killing prostitutes. Actually, that was a lie. This term, Jewess, is actually a Masonic code word. It refers to the 3 ruffians who murdered Hiram Abiff, Jubalo, Jubalah, and Jubalum. And this was a kind of roundabout way of saying the Masons will not be blamed for nothing. Now, if you want any further proof of this, I would direct your attention to what Jack the Ripper originally called himself, because he wrote letters describing his atrocities. And obviously, whether it was Dr. Gull or whether it was an accomplice who worked with Dr. Gull, we don't know. But we do know this. Many people have remarked that the killings themselves were obviously done by someone who was a surgeon. The cuts were done very, very carefully and with an extremely profound knowledge of human anatomy. Anyway, the first time, before Jack was called Saucy Jack or Jack the Ripper, the first nickname he gave himself was Leather Apron. Now, every Mason, when they are made a Master Mason, is given a white lambskin or leather apron. That is the badge of a Mason. Now, this illustrates how Masonry can be used and is often used to conceal crimes, even for a century. Now, let's move on. We'll talk now about the craft and politics, everybody's favorite subject. Most politicians, as everybody has probably observed, tend to be lawyers. As we've already discussed, most lawyers are Masons. Therefore, a lot of politicians are Masons. Many heads of state are Masons. At least 17 presidents of the United States have been Freemasons.
Bill Schnoblin there, who is himself a former Freemason. Thank you very much to Dalek's Tony Gosling for that report. And we'll be hearing the second half of that talk and all about Masonic politicians next week. And you can find that entire talk on the internet if you put Light Behind Masonry into your search engine.
And now we have Charles Thompson, who's in the studio with us, with his perspective as the veteran sports reporter that he is on the outcome of the World Cup. Hi, Charles. How are you doing?
Hi, Michaela. I'm doing very well, thank you.
Great. So talk to us.
Right, well, what can we say about the World Cup? Well, we can say it was a great World Cup because of it brought South Africa to life for the people of South Africa and for the people watching. Not only their dance enthusiasm, their joy, but also some of their history as well. And I think that was what was the great thing about it. And it was beautifully organised and it was a great celebration. As for the teams themselves, who shall I start with?
Well, I suppose we better talk about England and the disappointment that was.
Well, it was a great disappointment. So what can we say? Well, now we're looking back at it, we can say that perhaps if we're going to produce great English players, a great English team, what are we going to do? Mm-hmm. And one of the things we can do is we can train youngsters so they're not just learning how to win and show power and punch, but they're playing team football and learning how to pass to each other. Because Spain were the fantastic example of a superb passing team, and they've been passing like that. Great players, learning how to pass like that. We're learning how to work together since they were teenagers. And Spain and Holland, they spend a lot more time with young kids, training them how to play what we call egoless. Sounds rather Buddhist, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sounds good, doesn't it?
Yeah. Egoless football, where there were no individual big heads, but everyone is playing with each other, all aware of each other, and they're passing to each other as a matter of course. Sure. It's the only way that you can win at the very highest level. Mm-hmm. So that's something we can do with our youngsters, just pass.
You know? Yeah, because we have the big stars, but that, yeah, you're right, there was no passing that.
You know. And it's only if you pass for all your teenage and young life that you actually are able to pass when you get to an adult. So yeah. They've got to do that in terms of the training everywhere in Britain. What else can we do? Well, we need a manager who's flexible. All our greatest managers have been flexible, okay? And is Capello flexible? The jury is out with Capello. It was in, saying good man, good coach, yeah. But now it's gone out again and saying we're reconsidering our verdict.
Funny that, yeah.
Yeah, so he's got to be a bit more flexible. So if 4-5-1, do you understand these little number things? 4-5-1?
Yeah, Michaela? No, I understand that. Yeah, okay.
That's okay with you, is it? Yeah. 4-5-1 means just one forward up front, and all teams play with this, and it probably would have been the best tactic, but he wasn't able to change. Mm-hmm. So he needs to be flexible in terms of his formations. Is he going to be flexible? Well, time will tell. The other thing we've got to do is the Premier League, it's like a Globetrotters experience, isn't it, really? You get a huge number of people from all over the world, but
definitely.
You have to have more English people, and if you have more English players, they will learn at the highest level. Why were Germany so good? Michaela, can I ask you? No, I've got to ask myself.
Oh, I have no idea. Why were they
okay. Because all their young players play in the Bundesliga.
And they are young, aren't they? That's a point that lots of people would
they're young, but
up.
They've had hard, tough experience and a top level experience, and so they can play at a high level. Well, all our young people, they just hang around waiting on the subs bench.
Yeah. So, I mean, in what way were Spain and Holland, apart from passing, you know, the top teams of the tournament?
Well, Spain was a marvelous team. They had superb players, but had great character, great aggression, great sense of unity, and great desire to win. They didn't win by many goals. One floor in the World Cup, not enough goals.
Very low scoring indeed.
Absolutely low scoring. Not like the 1970 World Cup, but they did play absolutely wonderful play. But their defence was good. The defence could pass. Everyone could pass. Everyone could score goals. So not everyone, but the centre back scored a crucial goal. So that and Holland were a marvellous team right up to the final, which was fairly appalling because you don't want to lose like that.
No,
you know, lose playing very cynical, rough football and just trying to shake the opposition up.
Sure.
Because you decided that's the only way you can win. Because they nearly did it, because they had a couple of good chances to win that. But it would have been absolutely dreadful if they had won playing cynical, rough football like that.
And especially in a final as well.
Well, and everyone to follow them. Everyone say, oh, Holland won the World Cup by playing rough, nasty, dirty football. And so they'd all play the same. So it was great. They're a great team side playing great team football.
Sorry, just to interrupt. I mean, if you had one kind of moment that kind of defined it for you, just finish up.
All right, one moment defined the World Cup. Well, there was a moment when two moments, right? Can I have two moments?
You may have two.
The South African player scored the first goal for South Africa. That was a wonderful moment. The joy of the nation was wonderful. And then I think one of the great goals was the Spain scored. It was very late on in the semi-final when their really rough bull-like player called Puyol, who comes from the back, he flung himself at a corner ball with superb intensity, power, athleticism and just sheer guts to whack into the back of the net. You know, that spelt out character, determination, we want the cup, and great skill as well. That was my second moment of the World Cup.
Definitely. Well, thank you, Charles, for your post-mortem there, and hopefully in 4 years' time we'll be plenty of more excitement to look forward to as well.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Right, thank you very much to Charles Thompson there for coming in, and hopefully we'll get some more of him in the coming weeks and months. Conspiracy theories, yep, we're back to that again. Love them or hate them, most of us have an opinion one way or the other. Investigative journalist and historian David Southwell has been doing his best to get to the bottom of some of the world's most elaborate enigmas. In Secrets and Lies, his book, he confirms the old saying that truth really can be stranger than fiction when you take the time to dig out the hard facts behind the smokescreen of rumours and disinformation. David doesn't pretend to have all the answers, but what he's done is to employ an investigative journalist's eye to many riddles, modern and not so modern. And this week we hear about secret societies and the Moonies.
Secrets and Lies. Little Gifts from David Southwell. Every cult and secret society has things they do not want the uninitiated to know about. After all, it is their nature to keep things hidden from those who are not part of the in crowd. However, aside from the passwords, handshakes and rituals, they also tend to conceal the truth about their strange inner beliefs and real reasons for their existence, even from some of their own members. The compartmentalised structure of secrecy employed in most cult and occult societies means that even those who join an organisation at its lower levels will have no idea of its inner teachings and origins. For example, Freemasons at lower grades, known as the Blue Degrees, are intentionally misled, although it is intended that they will believe they have discovered the truth about the Brotherhood. This need-to-know approach means that few individuals in the following organisations know the truth about what is really going on and what the genuine history of their organisation actually is. Even some of those inside the organisations detailed in this book do not know the secrets you will hear in the next few minutes. Knowledge is power, and those in control of these groups are loath to tell many members, let alone the general public, what they genuinely believe and intend to do. Secrets are easier to keep if few people know them, but as we shall see, the truth leaks out, even from the most clandestine and tightly controlled secret society. When Bill Clinton took up his second term in the White House, he became the first to support the celebration of the African-American religious festival Kwanzaa. Speaking about it, he said, "The symbols and ceremony of Kwanzaa evoke the rich history and heritage of Africa. It is a vibrant celebration of African culture that transcends international boundaries." Kwanzaa is, in fact, nothing of the sort. It is an invented festival for a religion based not on African culture but upon Marxist principles, and created by Ron Karenga, a man who used to be a radical advocate of black separatism and who tortured women. A 7-day festival starting on December the 26th is promoted as an African-American alternative to Christmas. It is claimed that it is based on 7 ancient African principles, said to symbolise the 7 principles of blackness, and that it takes its name from a Swahili harvest festival. First created in 1966, it is now celebrated by more than 12% of African Americans, who may be surprised to learn that the principles, including Kujichagulia, self-determination, Ujima, collective work and responsibility, and Ujamaa, cooperative economics, derive from Marxism, not African culture. That no African people celebrate a harvest festival in December, and that some of its symbols, such as Muhindi, ears of corn, are not even native to Africa. Before coming up with this spurious festival and its accompanying religion, Kawaida, Karenga had been a member of the United Slaves Organization, a radical black power group that was in violent conflict with the Black Panthers. In 1971, Karenga was convicted of felonious assault and false imprisonment after torturing 2 women from the United Slaves who he thought were trying to poison him. During his trial, the prison psychiatrist reported that this man represents a picture which can be considered both paranoid and schizophrenic with hallucinations. Quite understandable, then, that George W. Bush continued to follow Clinton's tradition and give a presidential Kwanzaa message. On December the 26th, 2002, French scientist and bishop in the Raëlian UFO sect, Brigitte Boisselier, announced that the cult organisation Clonaid had cloned the first human baby, saying in a press conference, "I have created life." Refusing to reveal details of where the mother and alleged baby were, she promised that proof and independent testing of baby Eve would be allowed in the future to prove her claims. It later emerged that former French journalist Claude Vorion founded Clonaid. He claimed a UFO experience in 1973 had led him to rename himself Raël and form the Raëlian religion. Despite offering to create a clone for a fee of $200,000, evidence surfaced that the company had only 2 staff and had never cloned a sheep, let alone a human being. The big attraction of the Raëlian movement, aside from cloning and being able to believe that humanity was created by aliens who chose to pass on their message to a former writer on motor racing, is its teachings on sex, which are hedonistic to say the least. Before becoming the chief liar of the Clonaid hoax, Brigitte Boisselier was more infamous for her role of helping initiate people into the cult, which usually involved her leading groups of both male and female new recruits in exploring their darkest sexual fantasies. These often seemed to revolve around having group sex in candlelight accompanied by a soundtrack of whale song and chanting. When confronted by a Montreal newspaper with proof of a hoax, Vorion responded by saying, "If it's not true, she's making history with one of the biggest hoaxes ever. So it's wonderful because, thanks to what she is doing now, the whole world knows about the Raëlian movement. I am very happy with that." This means that a man asking us to believe he is telling the truth when he says his father was an alien and that he was taken in a flying saucer to meet Jesus and Buddha, who gave him a religious mission, is also saying it's fine to lie if it brings you publicity. Irony doesn't even begin to cover it. In the early 1970s, it was common to read reports about the worrying activities of a cult nicknamed the Moonies. There were proven cases of brainwashing and the extreme control exerted on the lives of the young followers, including providing them with previously unknown partners whom they would marry in mass wedding ceremonies involving thousands of people, Even as a child, I found the sight of the Reverend Sung Myung Moon, who proclaimed himself the Messiah and mankind's perfect parent, marrying crowds of transfixed people in football stadiums, troubling and scary. Others felt the same way because after years of bad press and Moon's imprisonment for tax evasion and conspiracy, the Korean billionaire and his unification movement decided to change tack. Using the millions of dollars provided to the church by its followers, Moon and the unification movement set up the Washington Times newspaper to promote right-wing views and provide an apparently impartial source of good publicity for the church. They also purchased United Press International, the respected global news agency. The church used profits generated by arms manufacturers and more than 500 other front businesses owned by the unification movement and himself to fund a network of powerful US conservative groups that would be pro-Mooney. Moon even started to fund the production of movies that would promote conservative views and act as secret Mooney propaganda. His first idea was to retell the story of Christ with a unification movement slant and Elvis in the lead role. Right up until the king's death, Moon made overtures to persuade him to exchange his Vegas capes for the robes of Christ. Presley refused to take a role that suggested Jesus was not the genuine king. According to Moon, as he himself was the Messiah, Jesus must have failed in his mission. Despite being knocked back by Presley, Moon went on to plough $48 million into the Korean-based war movie Incheon. Starring Laurence Olivier and Jacqueline Bisset, it was the most expensive and largest box office flop of its time. It seems that even messiahs can make bad movies.
That was a weekly extract from the People's Spies Non-Dodgy Dossier, David Southwell's book, Secrets and Lies. More next week. And Tim Burrows, the poet, is here with a poem for us. Hello.
Hi.
What has been happening to you lately and what sort of themes are in your poetry?
I was lucky enough to go to the WorldMed Festival, so I had 3 days of great music and inspiration, and the weather kept good. Yes, so this poem's got a sort of living at one and living with other people theme, and I wrote it in India, in Goa,
okay,
a few years ago when I was living there. So this is called Golden Bough. Looking for the edge of paradise, the golden bough, the Eden in the east, where technology has not touched, a place of harmony beside the sea, lapped by the waves, palm leaf shaded, bamboo secured, tuned to nature of being, I am with, I am one, om. No more shadows, open to see, open to possibility. With a calm mind's eye, no tears so clear, no fears, the way to be. What was lost can be found, full with full moon, wet with the sea, feet deep in sand, eyes clear with the sky, body kissed by the sun, hair stiff with salt. Floating, eyes closed, riding the tide, moved by the moon, crest, ripple, splash, watery like a womb, moving at one with the pulse of nature. The open bough hangs down, its leaves touch the earth, its branches reach the sky. United, it breathes eternity, united, it breathes eternally. United, it breathes in ecstasy. United, it breathes in unity. United, it is love. Bright-eyed child of the moon, straggling hair round crescent face, eyes not empty but full of life, knowing what it is to be, seeing what there is to see, breathing jasmine, feeling the warm earth, laughing with the sun, coursing with the river's water, touching bark of tree, cold stone, wet with the sea, greeting the new dawn, dancing carefree, with the pulse of life, of living, fully, whole, at one om.
Thank you very much to Tim Burrows. More next week.
And once again, we have Jeff Sparks. He's ready with his Song of the Week and his What Song Guide in a very fetching shirt today, Jeff.
Thank you, Michaela. Good afternoon. This is What Song Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Tuesday, 3rd of August, and the Norwegian electro-industrial group Combi Christ will be performing with support from Rabia Sorda and also Dismantled at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £15 in advance. On Friday, 6th of August, Taint will be performing with support from Manatees and also Gonga at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £6 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and I present the former Guns N' Roses guitarist Slash. This is from his debut solo album titled Slash, and it's a track titled Dr. Alibi, which features Lemmy from Motorhead. Slash with Dr. Alibi from the album Slash. For more information, you can go to www.ultimateguitar.com and search for Slash. Also on Friday, 6th of August, Larry Miller will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £7 in advance and £10 on the door. Into Saturday, 7th of August, and Bad Religion will be performing with support at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £15 in advance. Finally, on Tuesday, 10th of August, Agnostic Front will be performing with support from All Will Suffer and also FUK at the Beer Keller in All Saints Street, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £12.50 in advance and £14.50 on the door. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Great stuff. Thanks, Jeff. Well, that's all for this week.
Dialect Radio is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player. It's produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM across Bristol at 12 noon every Sunday. If you're on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed, which will remind you every Friday when Dialect is online. You can download our podcast from dialectradio.co.uk.
You can also find a low-quality mono version of Dialect for dial-up connections at bristol.indymedia.org every Friday morning, or if you're outside Bristol, you can listen live on the internet at bcfm.org.uk. Thanks to our studio guests, Guthrie Kennard and Charles Thompson. Reporters this week were Anthea Page and Tony Gosling, and studio production was by Lee Duffield. The producer was Tony Gosling.
The Watson Guide was brought to you by our very own Jeff Sparks, and the Poem of the Week was brought to you by Tim Burrows. Dialect Radio is a Bristol Radio Co-op production. Now, that means anyone can contribute. So if you'd like to do so, please contact us through Volunteering Bristol, a local organisation, on 0117 989 7733, which you can find on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect Radio. I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Michaela Dennis.
And we both wish you a very good week. So from all the team in Queen Square Studio in Bristol City Centre, thank you for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye.
BCFM 93.2 FM. Your choice, your voice.